Welcome back to the U.S. Naval History Podcast, and this week we're going to be talking about the launch of the world's first steam-powered warship, known as the Fulton I, which was the first baby step in the gradual transition from the age of sail to the age of steam. And this transition was necessitated because the United States was blockaded by Britain during the War of 1812, and we were hopelessly outgunned and outmanned by the Royal Navy, and we're depending on sort of a miracle cure, and that came in the form of technology, hopefully, to break the Royal Navy's crippling blockade, and in this case of New York City. And with me to discuss this, I have Andrew Fagel, who is an associate editor of the papers of Thomas Jefferson at Princeton University, and he's done a lot of really interesting research on the arms industry and military technology in early American history. So welcome, Andrew.
Yeah, Chase, it's great to be here.
So I'm paraphrasing your research a little bit, but this steam-powered warship was launched, and it caused a bit of a mixed reaction among the British, and obviously Americans had high hopes for it, and the British were, in one sense, optimistic. They had the greatest navy, and they had had the greatest navy for almost two centuries at this point.
Yeah.
But this warship was supposedly vulnerable to rockets and red hot shot, which is basically heated up red hot cannonballs that would cause your ship to burn. So some people said, it's not a real threat. But you've done a lot of research and shows that the British newspaper records and their intelligence reports and their traveler accounts describe how the British took this invention very seriously and were pretty worried, in fact, that it could upset the balance of power in North America and in Europe.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, if you think about this, the Fulton I is launched in early 1815 after the war between Britain and the United States, and the War of 1812 is already over. And if you think about why it's needed, is that Britain obviously has naval superiority over the United States. And this goes back to 20 years of early American naval policy of how do you deal with the British? Do you build a ocean-going navy, 74 gunships to the line? Or the critique of that view is we'll never be able to outmatch the British in that type of naval conflict. We're not France. We're not Spain. We don't have the same kind of economy and manpower. So we have to look at other things. So do we look at gunboats? Do we look at fortifying the harbors? And during the War of 1812, Robert Fulton, who's an inventor, he comes up with the idea of what if we attach a steam engine and a paddle wheel to a boat, and we can use this as a form of harbor defense. And floating batteries had existed prior to 1815. They had been used by the French and the Spanish during the Siege of Gibraltar. There are these big hulks of ships that are not necessarily meant to be maneuverable on the high seas, but you can put them into place and you get a lot of cannon firing at a specific area. It's a barge with cannons on it. There's a couple of period prints that depict the Fulton, and it kind of looks like Noah's Ark in some ways, is how I would describe it, without the house on top, just
right
big barge. I actually was
thinking more porcupine, right? Because it's big, sort of oval, and it's got slots for 30 cannons, just equally arrayed all around it.
Yeah,
and you know, it's pretty, you know, it's 153 feet long and 58 feet wide, so it's pretty wide a beam compared to length, especially compared to standard ship dimensions.
Right. No, absolutely. And I think it's also has a catamaran hull with the paddle wheel is between the two. I think there's actually a very good model at the Naval Academy in the museum that they have there that was done based off of plans that still survive in the Danish National Archives. Because, as evidenced by the response in Britain, all of the European powers become aware of the Fulton I, and they want their own ways to defeat British naval superiority in this period of Napoleonic Wars. Because one of the things that we forget is that from the perspective of 1815 is that they don't know that the Napoleonic Wars are over. It's like, yeah, Napoleon's been defeated. We're going to send him all the way over to St. Helena. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the wars are over. And they're still preparing for different ways. And one of the ways in which different European countries are preparing for this is how do we beat British naval superiority? And they start turning to the American inventions from the War of 1812. So there's this French delegation that comes over to the United States in 1817, 1818, right around there, to study the Fulton the First. And they're the ones who probably make copies of all the plans. And a copy of those plans makes it into the Danish National Archives, because Denmark very much wants a good way to defend Copenhagen, because twice during the Napoleonic Wars, Britain raids Copenhagen in order to make sure that the Danish fleet does not end up allied with the French, because Britain's big grand strategy is they need to rule the waves. They need to control maritime commerce. And the way you do that is you prevent opponents from having their fleets and from having fleets in being, even if they're stationed in a port. So you go into Copenhagen, you take out the Danish fleet. You can think of even more modern context with World War II, where they go after the French fleet, and I think it was Oman in North Africa. Same kind of deal.
Right. So just the fact that there is a neutral fleet does not mean that it will be neutral forever. And especially when you have the Germans with Vichy France or Napoleon with Denmark. And Napoleon very much was seen in a Hitler-esque manner back in the early 1800s. I mean, it truly is a very parallel. They did not see Napoleon as morally superior to how the British of the early 1940s saw Hitler. They saw them both as evil, evil, evil despots.
Yeah. I mean, the amount of times that I've seen Napoleon compared to the Antichrist, and both Americans and British trying to prove using the Bible that Napoleon is the Antichrist that's been predicted. It's fascinating. In that they view him as the epitome of evil. Not everyone does that, of course, but there's quite a lot of people in Britain and America that view him as such.
I mean, he was sort of Napoleon and the Pharaoh, the biblical Pharaoh, were seen as the default really bad guy who sort of got planted by Hitler post-World War II. But before that, if you saw a reference in literature or something to Napoleon or the Pharaoh, that was your stand-in for really bad dude. Hitler today, if you were to call someone Hitler, it's like, you're calling him a bad person, right? So going back to the Fulton the First, this first steam-powered warship, it was somewhat of a technological marvel. It had thick hulls. It had that central paddle wheel, so it wasn't very fast, but it could definitely catch a becalmed ship, such as off of Long Island Sound. And the great advantage of a steamship is that it doesn't need the wind, right? There is no wind. Right. Great. All to its advantage. You can go against the wind, go up and down rivers. Great technological improvement. And then you can also have a flatter bottom due to its construction, which means that it's not as bound by low harbors and choke points around river systems and deltas. So it's really a great technological leap. And it also had sort of a steam engine pump that could pump water onto the deck. It's sort of a very, very early precursor to, you know, sort of a modern fire suppression system, maybe like an AFFF system. And it was great. And the French wanted to get their hands on it. And we gave them the plans. Why was it, actually? That was something I was curious about.
Yeah, I mean, that is a very good question. I don't know the specifics, but there is a newspaper report in the United States from 1815, and it's complaining about how you have all these foreign dignitaries coming to the United States, and American military officers are showing them all the latest and greatest in American military technology. So it's complaining, we're showing them our steam frigates, which is the Fulton the First. We're showing them our repeating guns. We're showing them our torpedoes. We're showing them our mutes. The mute was kind of like semi-submersible that Fulton's also working on at this point. And it's, why are we doing this? This is just boasting. We're going to be giving away all these technological secrets. And so I think one element is there is a confraternity of military officers, regardless of nationality, where they're just willing to talk and show people. I think there's probably maybe a little bit of bragging going on. It also is possibly, look at our kit. You can't possibly deal with us.
A deterrence effect, perhaps.
Exactly, a deterrence effect. And on top of that is that they don't really have any kind of laws regulating the exportation of this type of military technology. So the Dutch, they're trying to get these repeating guns from different naval sources. They can't get them. Eventually, they're just able to buy one from the manufacturer in Philadelphia. So
that would be equivalent of Lockheed Martin selling an F-35 to some neutral country without government approval, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, and there's even letters that survive between the Secretary of the Navy and one of these inventors basically saying, like, look, if you want us to still buy your stuff, stop selling it to foreign powers. And the guy is, he's more interested in making money, I think, than providing a one-on-one of support for the Navy or the Army or whomever. So very free market in that sense.
Yeah. So unfortunately for naval history, the Fulton the First never got a chance to go take on the Royal Navy because a peace treaty was signed at the very end of 1814. Then it got ratified by the Senate in February of 1815, and the Fulton was launched just before that. And so a week later, Fulton dies, commensurate inventor, but he never gets to see his technology in action. But obviously, looking back, steam is very clearly the future, although that was not clear to many naval officers who were traditionalists quite a long time. But can you talk a little bit about how the British and the rest of the Europeans and the Americans reacted in sort of the near term to integrate steam into their fleets?
Yeah. So at least from the British perspective, is that it comes in waves, is that during the war, they have some intelligence reports, spies basically, who are feeding information back to the Admiralty over the development of this weapon system. And they seem to be fairly concerned, but you know, you make sure that the information is getting out there and you can find a way to deal with it. This then gets turned into a number of newspaper reports in Britain, start publishing stories, and as can happen with a unknown technology or an unknown event, is that things start getting exaggerated, blown out of proportion a little bit. But also, even if things are getting exaggerated and blown out of proportion, there's oftentimes a kernel of truth to all of this. So So the way the ship's designed to basically keep any kind of solid shot from reaching the vessel itself. And so that then becomes, oh, this thing is impervious to any kind of shot. And if you go back to what's going on in Britain during this period, is that they have a real fear that, you know, just in standard ship construction, the Americans have a leg up with old Ironsides, the USS Constitution. And so there,
it's because we have that Southern live oak, which is a tremendously hard wood to work with, and also very hard, physically hard, in part because it's old growth forest, in part just because the nature of it, and that both makes it extremely difficult to work with, but also makes it a really good warship material.
Right. And so when people say old Ironsides, is in part because you then get these Englishmen saying, I know the ship is actually encased in iron. It's an ironclad, which it's not. But that same kind of idea of the Americans are forming this technology that's going to defeat the ability of our cannon to defeat it. Like if all of our ships have cannon, how are we going to deal with this thing? And so the main response is like, okay, we'll set it on fire, because fire and wood has been a traditional naval technology going back to ancient Greece and Rome, right? And they have red hot shot, where you heat up a cannonball in a furnace and then you ram it down and you fire that at your opponent's ship. And the idea is the red hot shot gets stuck into the hull and it sets the ship on fire. And the way that navies would deal with this, you know, it's on the ocean, there's lots of water, you have buckets, you can try to cool it down that way. You can also smother fires with blankets or extra sails that may happen to be on deck at that time. So navies have ways of dealing with this. But one of the things that Fulton seems to have worked into the design of the ship is that if there's red hot shot that gets impregnated into the hull, you can release boiling water from the steam engine itself onto the hull and extinguish any flames or lower the temperature on the iron shot itself.
And that same boiling water was feared by the British, because four main tactics in this era. One is you aim for the hull and you sink the ship. You know, the Fulton was built to be impervious to that. Two is you aim at the sails and render it immobile. The Fulton didn't really depend on sails, so scratch that one. And three was you burn it. Okay, well, can't burn this one. Four is you board the ship. But it's pretty hard to board a ship if you have boiling water being sprayed on the boarding party.
Yeah, and so that's one of the other things that they say. It's like, oh, well, they can spray the boiling water at the landing party. You know, I think there's a fear that some of these newspapers have. It's like, oh, yeah, the Americans are just going to spray us with boiling water if we go on board.
Can you sketch out the next generation of steam-powered warships and very broadly how that rest of that transition away from sails and towards steam evolves, of which the Fulton really was the first?
Yeah, I mean, so this transition to steam, I mean, it takes another 40 years to really...
And more. 40, I mean, they're still using sails in the Civil War extensively.
Right, yeah. So, yeah, exactly. I mean, it is a decades-long transition time. So what you have happen in Britain is there's a study that's commissioned by the Admiralty to figure out, does steam have a future in the Royal Navy? And the initial report is yes, but in a limited way. We're going to use it for these kind of small boats. But everyone realizes that if you can hook up a steam engine to a ship of some sort and have that work, you're going to have all the advantages that steam power will provide. And then when you add on a screw propeller instead of a paddle wheel, even better. So you start getting some of these early steamships in the British and American navies, I think in the 1830s, and they're integrated where they have screw propellers by the next decade. And really by the Civil War, you have both ships, both kinds of technologies being used. And by the time you get to iron-hulled ships, it's clear that steam is going to be the way forward. But yeah, I mean, the Civil War is very much the U.S. Navy, you know, and the Commerce Raiders, the Alabama, they're sail vessels for the most part. But a lot of the close-in encounters of the blockade, you know, you're going to be having steam vessels doing a lot of that stuff. So like the Kearsarge outside of South Carolina.
And then, you know, very quickly after that, the Civil War really is the swan song of sails, and technology improves both on the metallurgy front and on the engine front, and sails very quickly fade to the point that you have just a few decades later, the Spanish-American War, in which, you know, it is abundantly clear that we are now in the big gun era, and big guns are fundamentally not compatible with sails.
Right.
Well, that is fascinating. Thank you very much, Andrew. Again, this is Andrew Fagel. I'm going to put a link to his work in the show description. You can always email me at usnavalhistorypodcast@gmail.com. Let me know what you think about the show. Give me a 5-star rating, write a review, tell your friends about it, spread the word. And until next time, fair winds and following seas.